We're going to continue this idea of this question of people wanting to put our era in a box. I just did a podcast recently about how this era that we're living in, our time, I think, is completely unique. And we're going to extend that to talk about business. And I'm going to do that with Todd Rooker, financial consultant extraordinaire. And we're going to do that in podcast 827, the Bob Davis Podcasts. So, yeah, we are live in mobile podcast command outside the world headquarters of Todd Rooker's amazing financial consulting company, The Empire, the 40-story building. And we're going to be talking about business. But the thing is, one of the great things about business today, one of the new developments that's probably been around for 25, 30 years, really, as a technology, is a payment processor. And, of course, ReliaFund is a sponsor of the Bob Davis Podcast. And they have been part of the payment processing revolution from the get-go. Why? Because we like to get paid faster and we like to get paid more effectively. But more importantly, we want a payment processor that can integrate into the systems we already have. So that's the great thing about ReliaFund. A lot of these payment processors, you are locked into their approach to doing things. ReliaFund is very flexible. They will work with your developers, whether you're developing a website or whether your guys are working on back office stuff. And it's so important. ReliaFund is a payment processor that's been providing integrated solutions to get payments cleared for more than two decades. Again, you will talk to a human being if you want to talk to ReliaFund. You're going to talk to Kevin Hill or Greg Lowry. Great guys. They're technology-focused, no long-term contracts, and secure. 866-243-5040, 866-243-5040, or check them out online at ReliaFund.com, ReliaFund.com, and I'll be telling you more about ReliaFund.
You want to get paid fast.
I was going to say something else, and I forgot what it was, but there's a lot I could say about ReliaFund, but we'd be here all day.
All right.
I did a podcast recently, and it was motivated to a certain degree by politics. And this is this idea that that I see on TV, and I read it all the time, where somebody is comparing our era to some other era, and it's gotten to the point where I felt like I needed to say something. And the idea is somehow we're like the antebellum South, or we're like the 1920s or something to that effect. And I understand why people do that. You got some theories about that as well. And we did a radio show together recently. We talked about some of the new marketing things like podcasting and digital and things of that nature. And I thought it'd be great to continue this in relation to business, because I think sometimes we do things because that's the way we've always done it before. That's the way Grandpa did it when he had the business. That's the way Dad did it when he had the business. So we just continue to do things that way. I think we're living in an unprecedented era. I think this is a unique era in history. We're making history today. Nothing is written. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Todd Rooker.
Well, thank you very much. That is quite a lead-in. And, you know, I think here's the first observation I would throw forward. You and I are both the baby boomer era.
Yeah.
And I think our era is really caught in the middle of all of this, because we were brought up in an era where there was a form of stability and predictability in one's life and one's work. And the reality is that the millennials don't think that way. They are programmed to adapt, and to be open and welcoming to that ongoing dramatic change, that, you know, the continual disruptive technology that we are frustrated with, because right about the time we get comfortable with a new way of doing things or a new technology, another one comes along, and it's just frustrating to us because we keep looking for the stability in our lives to be able to stand on something and have it be predictable.
Yeah, but I don't feel that way at all, and
well,
I don't think you do either.
That's great. No, well, I remember the radio show that I did.
I mean, personally.
Right. Well, the radio show that I did with my brother-in-law, who I love dearly, he's a great guy. But, you know, the whole, so what are you doing now, you know, Todd? And of course, I'm a businessman who's in the financial industry, and so I adapt and I change and I do whatever I need to do. I have a wide grasp of business and finance. I can do anything in that realm. But to him, the minute you change something, he's a pharmaceutical rep. That's what he does. And he defines himself that way. And the idea of changing is inconceivable to him. He's been doing it for 30 years, and he can't imagine changing. So he's the difference in the paradigm of adapt and change versus stability. And I'm going to retire with my traditional retirement account and everything's going to be fine. Young people don't look at things that way. And I do believe that you know, as you said, not everyone, but to look to the past as a barometer, as a way to say, here's what happened in the past, this is going to happen again. And one of the favorite guys right. I have is Ray Dalio, who really is a financial
love magic Ray man. Dalio.
He's yeah, great. And he says another one of those, because what he says is that everything that happens economically has happened in the past and will happen again. And you need only have the aptitude to reach back that far. Because it may not be 10 years ago, maybe a long time ago.
Statistically, yeah, in terms of the markets and in terms of trends, I'm more talking about society. I'm just thinking that what's happening is we're being told to think a certain way. And everyone's being told to think, well, this is going to happen next. We're going to have a civil war in this country. It's going to be like the 1920s. The stock market's going to crash and we're going to have this horrible depression, which may or may not be true. And a depression today might not look like a depression in 1929. We have all this disruptive stuff that is nothing like. It's much more significant than the introduction of the disruptive technologies in the early 20th century. Which was the automobile and flight and the telephone.
But don't you think that
they were disruptive, but not on the level
that this
is.
Don't you think that all relates to just exactly what I've said? In so much as the change came, we had time to adapt and become
comfortable
saying with it.
It's happening.
I'm saying
so
the
fast.
Waves of change are happening so fast that we can't prepare, and that's what I'm saying is a problem. I mean, the least of which, of course, is coming, which is AI, the artificial intelligence, right. Which has the capacity to displace so many people. And what will they do when they can't go to work and be fulfilled in what they do day in and day out? I mean, you know, I guess you can work out a lot more, but it's going to be challenging.
Yeah, they'll have to find something else to do.
Oh, man. It's going
to
be challenging financially, economically, and emotionally and psychologically. It's going to be challenging.
And it won't be our generation. It will be the people. But
well,
you
don't
just
say
said
that.
That they're
we don't know that. But the progression of change, I don't know that that's true. I think that because, one, we're living longer and longer, you know, in 10 years from now, the world can be radically different than it is right now. And I don't think, here again, we're prepared for that. It's happening faster than we acknowledge.
Well, here's the question. Should we prepare for it, or should we be mentally prepared to accept that there are going to be things that are going to happen so fast we're not going to be prepared for, and say, okay, I'm not going to necessarily prepare for, I'm not going to predict what's going to happen. I'm not going to prepare for what I think's going to happen. I'm going to prepare myself mentally and physically to be ready to accept what happens.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. I think for us growing up, that wasn't something we had to be concerned with. And of course, the younger you are, the more easily you are adaptive to change. And the older you get, the more set in your ways you become, and the more challenging it is. So we're in that split. And that's what I'm trying to say. I mean, to just have something just turn on a dime and say, oh, that's the new way. And then everything in your thinking radically changes to you know, bring that into your methodology of vetting things. I don't know that everybody's good at that. I don't, and you have to be so open to it, and that's challenging. So, you know, I'll bring it back around to business, because I think
that was going to be my next question.
so much of this, you know, is in business. You know, we do valuation and we help people sell businesses. And so an example of that is, many times someone will purchase a business or acquire or buy a business, and the metric that was used to value the business was done by someone who owned the business at the time, and it was in their best interest.
Right.
And so the person who purchased it knew less, accepted that metric, and then went about, after purchasing the business, probably figured out they had been had maybe somewhere along the line. But because that's the way it was valued, they obviously want it to be that way. So it's like this cognitive dissonance, right?
That's the word.
Oh, yeah.
That is exactly the word.
And the way they deal with that psychology is by the human being's ability to delude oneself is just amazing. And so they will say the incorrect information over and over again, And in life, isn't that the case? That if enough, forgive me, dumb people say incorrect information over and over again, apparently it becomes correct simply by virtue of the number of times it's said.
And this is the issue I have with all of these people saying it's going to be like this. I get why Ray Dalio, whatever it is, Dalio says, you know, if you look at market trends, you know, I know because I know statistically that things, quote unquote, history repeats itself, although every condition it might be a little bit different on
nuances,
the ground when it happens.
Slight differences, sure.
But this is different. This is, I mean, I know for a fact that when I shifted from broadcasting to doing podcasting, there was a huge process that's really still going on, which is you're not an employee anymore. You have to think like a business person.
Oh,
and
man.
You have to, that's a really tough one.
That's a huge challenge, especially for small business people. I'll finish off what I began saying about the person who purchases the business. When they go out into the world and now they try to sell it, they've reached the end of their tenure in that business and now they want to sell it. Maybe they want to retire, what have you. And then they go to somebody like us and we do a valuation or a business broker who tells them what the business is really worth on the open market. Well, they don't like that. And so what winds up happening is, one, the banks won't give the person who wants to buy it financing because the metric was wrong from mm-hmm. the very beginning 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so the only alternative they have is to sell it to, listen to this, their family or the current employees. And so the disease goes forward. And that's so much the way it is in the world. It's like people saying that the best investment you can make is your single family home. Well, that's flat out incorrect information as it relates to money and finance.
I've been saying that for years. And I said it once on the radio and took calls for an hour with people telling me that I was wrong.
Oh, and it is wrong.
Unless someone's renting part of it.
But right, but it's not really your fault so much as the fact that it's common knowledge. And even though common knowledge is commonly incorrect, never mind the fact that the common knowledge...
It's not common sense. It's common knowledge.
That's right. And you know, here's the other thing. We all want what we want, and we all want to... We project ourselves financially in the things that we do and the things that we own, and so we use these metaphors and these acronyms and these parables that have been talked about for years because it fits the narrative that we want.
Right.
Right? Because if we've been pursuing something for 20 or 30 years and now to find out that what we've been told and believed isn't correct, we don't want to hear that. And so that cognitive dissonance is then handled by us by saying it over and over again and by getting around other people who will continue to say the same thing, that it fits the narrative and we can justify what we wanted to do all along, but because we've been conditioned to think that way. Business, money, and finance is so much about that and so much less about simple objectivity in the numbers. You would love to think that it is, but really in the world, it's not.
Well, it's like saying, what kind of company are we? We're a direct mail company, or we are a direct seller. We have a website and we sell clothing on our website. And I think Jeff Bezos has proven that you have to think a little differently in terms of what, because there are a number of different companies. They do a lot of different things. They don't just sell stuff online. And you know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, Amazon is a giant server. You can get you can have your website live at Amazon servers, and some people swear by it. We don't. I use another company, but it's interesting to me that a lot of people are completely unaware of that, unless they're in the business, that you can get your website, you know, hosted at Amazon. Stuff like that everyone's
just think about what Amazon does today.
And they started as a bookseller.
30
really?
Years ago, how you would have explained what they do today. Yeah, 30 years from now, there's going
Impossible.
To be this company that does this. And they look at you and they say, what, you mean like a mail order business? Well, no, I don't mean a mail order business, but, and what do they do and what do they sell? Well, they sell everything.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, they started out with books,
right?
And I completely forgot about that.
And see, that's a point that leads me back to the what I said about my brother. What are you doing now? See, there's a difference between somebody who is a business person, because if a person... individuals typically get into small businesses because they've already got an aptitude in what they're doing. And the alternative would be to be an employee, and maybe they either can't find a job at the moment or they just want to have a little more freedom and more control. And
maybe, or they want to stick it to the man.
Yeah, right.
That
and maybe
was me.
Maybe get the upside potential, not have anybody standing in between them and their money.
Right.
Maybe that's it too. But the reality is they're not business people. Because a business person, and I'll use this perfect analogy of an insurance guy. I've got an insurance guy who we have helped him purchase insurance agencies. He's now got 9 insurance agencies. He hasn't sold insurance for over 10 years. Hasn't sold a policy. So he's not the guy who runs around trying to sell the most policies and win all the trips.
He's running the business.
He is a business person who just happens to be in the insurance industry. His whole goal is to buy, you know, these crusty insurance agencies that are, you know, got a guy who's ready to retire and just barely kicking along to get his money every single month. And he goes in with the efficiency of a business person, buys that business, uses it to purchase the real estate that the business, that the agency occupies, and makes it run more efficiently than it ever has before. And then once he gets that rolling, puts people in, moves on to the next one, and the next one, and the next one. Makes these little suckers run like, hum like a top.
So he's not selling insurance, he's
right.
managing and
I mean,
and,
he has an insurance license
company.
To be sure.
Right, of course.
And he certainly has done that, but he was questioning whether or not insurance was the business he wanted to be in. It wasn't, I want to be an insurance agent. It was, what kind of business can I be in to do this thing? And the irony is that the industry is dominated by people who don't think this way. So although it's been around forever, he came at it with a business perspective, and he is enormously successful. So he's a business person who just happens to be in a particular business, not necessarily, and tomorrow he could change that, change the product, change the service, and take his methodology, his accounting software, and he can move right into something else and be enormously successful again. And that would freak everybody out who knows him, because they're all associating him with the insurance.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so in the second half of this podcast, I want
to
talk about
getting down into,
doesn't take as long, want to get down into how this cognitive dissonance, if you will, really messes up the operation of a business, almost any kind of business. And we're not talking necessarily about just small businesses. It can be medium-sized business, and it can be large businesses, and we'll do that in the second half of this podcast, live from Mobile Podcast Command at World Headquarters for Todd Rucker's financial consulting business extraordinaire. Is that the name of the business? That should be the...
No, but I like it. Rucker Financial Consulting.
There you go. Well, before we get into this thing about business, I want to talk about being injured at work or at play. And I'm going to talk about a guy both of us know very well because we network together, and that is John D. Scott.
Oh, yes.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong.
John is very dry,
but yes. Great sense of humor, and a great way of explaining to people why you need a personal injury attorney. And he shares these stories, and I've got my favorites. You know, he doesn't ever say who. But the one that really sticks, especially this time of the year, as people are getting ready to get the boat in the water, was the kid that went water skiing and the boat ran over his leg.
Oh,
and
geez.
And John worked diligently to get that kid his life back and to get him squared away because the medical bills were ridiculous. Do you have any favorites that he... Then what he talked about the guy that got caught in the revolving door. It's like, who gets caught in
these stories? He comes, I mean, and you're so right. He's so dry and so disarming. So he'll talk along in this monotone voice, and he'll hit the punchline, and you'll just crack up because you don't expect it.
But it's real.
It's real, yeah. And he's a great attorney.
Right.
He really is.
And you need somebody to really help you through the thicket of insurance these days, because companies don't cover. They don't want to pay, and the companies that you're working for, if you're injured and you're working for a company, they expect you to come back to work in 2 weeks. They don't care that you broke your leg on the loading dock or something. And the thing is, this is why you need a personal injury attorney, because they can negotiate through all this. And it doesn't necessarily mean going to court. Sometimes going to court's the worst thing. Sometimes you just need somebody to figure out
the fact that you have an advocate. on your side.
So here's his number, 952-683-1351. Put John's number aside because you never know that you're going to need it. An accident comes usually without any warning, especially when you're having fun or working, because that's why they call it an accident. So I've given you a couple of examples. You know, this, to a certain extent, they're horror stories. But then there are things like the lady that got hit in the rental car while she was on a business trip, where these things can happen and you need somebody. So John D. Scott of Hoffman Hamer and Associates is the guy. He's a great personal injury attorney. Here's his number, 952-683-1351. That's 952-683-1351. John D. Scott of Hoffman Hamer and Associates. Click on the banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcast.com for more info. I want to get into how this cognitive, it's really not cognitive dissonance, it's just believing the lie. It's living the lie and how it really can screw up a business. So we've been sitting here talking and we've kind of come up with, and I think cognitive dissonance, which I couldn't even define. I know what you mean when you say it. It's hard for me to define it. But I would say it's also living the lie. And why am I talking about this? Because we are absolutely saturated in people on television and in the media and commentary from all walks of life. It isn't just politics. It isn't just society. It's business media as well. This is what's going to happen because this is what happened before. You know, they did this and they said this is going to happen, so then this is going to happen. And nobody says, well, it might not happen that way. And I think there's a lot of people going along in life and living their lives because people say this is what you're supposed to do because this is what's going to happen. And I'm wondering whether businesses, all size businesses, but we end up talking a lot about smaller businesses, can really get way off track, because it's just like in space. If you make a tiny miscalculation and you're trying to go to Jupiter, you're going to end up in Pluto.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And you're going to be way off course.
Yeah. So, and it is very much about, it isn't just small business. That part is true, because every business gets entrenched in a business model. And then when confronted with new data that just radically changes everything, they're entrenched in this business model.
And everybody in the business
is entrenched. Absolutely. And they've got 10,000 people working for them. How do you just literally turn everything around and keep everybody employed and adapt to this brand new technology when you have a model that you've been pursuing that you're 3/4 of the way into?
How do you do it?
Well, and that's a problem. And then you don't. And that's the problem. And that's why it takes so little to be antiquated in today's world. It's all of what we talk about, that psychology. It really is. So, you know, the interesting thing, though, is that everything relates to psychology. And although I'm in the financial world, psychology is so much a pivotal issue.
I know that because you always talk about that. It always ends up really being about psychology.
And it's frustrating, but it's true.
Yeah.
And to forego that aspect is to miss the forest for the trees. It really is. Because anybody, it's like budgeting. You know, you hear me say this all the time. Anybody can do a budget. So why does everybody seem to have such a heck of a time doing it? And it isn't because the math, because the Excel spreadsheet does it for you, and a third grader could do it without the Excel spreadsheet. So it's not that. It's that we want what we want, when we want it. We don't want anybody telling us we can't. And we come up with reasons to justify it, and we purposefully delude ourselves to see what we want to see. It's all about that. And so when you inject the human psychology into business decisions, into personal financial decisions, and the least of which is this whole thing that we all have a tape running in the back of our minds that says, I always knew you'd never be successful. And that's our perception of what other people think of us. And so what we attempt to do is to
prove. Are we all that way?
We're all that way to lesser or greater degrees.
Really?
Yes, of course we are. And so the question just becomes, what are the things that you use to,
yeah, that was my next question.
What are the tools that you use to demonstrate who you are and your self-importance and all of that kind of stuff? Because we all want to feel important. We all want to feel like what we do is important. You know, it cracks me up when I listen to politicians who want to talk about the average person, but then they use a vocabulary that the average person can't understand. So they're trying to simultaneously demonstrate their knowledge.
Like we're all
blue-collar
guys.
They're smarter than everybody else, but yet they want to talk to the average person. I mean, there's a reason why newspapers are written at the fifth grade level. But yet people who will aspire to save the world want to demonstrate that they are learned and that they have advanced degrees, and so consequently the vocabulary that they choose to embrace is one that alienates the very people they're trying to talk to. I mean, it happens all the time, doesn't it?
Well, a really gifted politician knows that. They understand how to
and
to
it, but it
do
takes
that.
Years to have that training.
Either that or you're just a natural. And right. You know, as you know, you don't have to be a natural. You just have to be able to be trained. So the way it plays out for me is I'll come up with this paradigm or this precept or this plan, and I'll go down the road and I have to really think a lot about what I'm doing. And one of my things was pricing my spots and how to figure out how to price it. And it took me a long time to finally say, I've got to reduce the prices of this and get this to find a price point.
Right.
And I just feel like I need to shorten the decision process of that. So that's the other thing, is that you start a business and you have a series of ideas behind the business that you're going to do, and this is how it's going to be. And you go down the road and you it's this balance between being absolutely sure of what you're doing and then starting to think, well, maybe that's not exactly what maybe I'm wrong about that, which is terrifying, because then you're like, well, I've gone down the road 6-7 months with this particular idea. Now I got to change that. And what's that going to cost me? And what does it cost me in terms of progress, in terms of growing the business and everything else?
Well, it starts with this whole thing, just like, you know, it starts with this whole thing of, what are you passionate about, honey? Pursue your passion. Well, you pursue your passion, honey, and maybe nobody wants to pay for your passion. You know, you're fulfilled and all that, and you're broke. You know, great. So this is why I did a post, a long-winded post on, I think, Facebook and LinkedIn, and it says, so you want to start a business.
Yes.
And the whole premise of that is that don't begin with what you love, but look at all the things that you could love and then define it by which one will create the most leverage. That is to say, which one will make the most money for time spent. I always like to say that a business, if you can think like a business is interested in two things only: what makes the most and costs the least. That's it. And so when you start with that, you say, what does the world want, need, and more importantly, are willing to pay for? And then consider of those things what fits within your aptitudes, your skill set, your core. Right. And then of those three things, which one of those will create the most leverage? See, and nobody thinks, and small business people never think that
way. Well, I'm
an
artist.
Yeah, you know, exactly. They never think that way. And that's why they don't succeed in business oftentimes. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they invent the disruptive technology we're talking about. And that's great. And ironically, though, a lot of people, they'll raise billions of dollars in a private placement and an offering, and then they won't have a model that works, and everybody else gets caught up in the stupidity as well, right? You've got to have, I mean, when the internet began, they just had these great ideas without any plan to monetize these great ideas, and yet you had people throwing millions and millions of dollars at these ideas that had no financial model.
It still happens.
And that's what happens in small business. That's what happens in small business. They
just
want to pursue their passion.
Yeah.
You know, and if your passion sucks or your passion can't be monetized specifically, then although it may be great and may fulfill you, how are you going to put food on your table? And how are you going to grow and scale that business?
Right. Well, that was what our conversation was about, scaling. And when I heard you say, really, the thing about podcasting is that you can take a podcast and scale the podcast. I mean, you don't have to do anything else except spend money.
It's like the
to
record
scale.
Industry or the CDs right. or the, you know.
You can increase the size of your audience. It's a little more difficult if you're doing granite countertops, because you can't be the guy that does the granite countertops anymore.
That is so correct.
So my challenge is, you know, how to take an artistic business, which is what this is to a certain degree, because what I do is make podcasts. And that's my passion.
And you're great at it, Bob. And, you know? And you're passionate about it.
But I got to figure out how to scale
it. And you have to just consider the financial aspects. And another point that I made in that post is that you want to be on the high side or the low side and not hover in the middle. So, you know, if I'm gonna charge less for my service, then I need more people. So I do a radio show. And the guy before me, Jason Walgrave, is an awesome guy. He has got so many sponsors.
Oh, we talked about this last week.
Yes, yeah. and he has much less, and so he's diversified amongst many. And if anyone quits, it's not any big deal to him, because he has, you know, 30 plus sponsors. I, on the other hand, have less than a third of those, and each one of my sponsors are paying $1,000 to $3,000 per month to be sponsored on my radio show. I lose one or two, and I'm in trouble. The world changes. So I have chosen to be on the high end of this and be more specific, more bespoke in the way that I present their product and service. He, on the other hand, will sometimes have two or three different sponsors on the same one-hour radio show where everybody just
and
gets
these,
their
these
piece
are
of
paid
the action.
Shows. These are paid shows.
Right, so, and, exactly. And
so
this
that
is
you
just
can a, do that with a paid
right,
show.
And it's just, it just demonstrates a different perspective on the low side, which is more about volume and speed, and the high side, which is more about uniqueness and higher price.
Right.
So, you know, when you are considering your business, you very much have to consider where you're going to land and not try to be all things to all people at the same time, because it's not a good approach. Now, you can
now
create-
what about, here's, we're running out of time, so I want to, and you and I will talk all day about this, but how do you, so let's suppose somebody takes over the family business, and Grandpa was the guy that was running the business, and he was amazing, and back in the day, he had five telephones on his desk and everything else. And now you've taken over the business and everybody tells you, you know, your grandpa, this is the way he did things and you don't want to mess with that. How does a person deal with that situation in a business where everybody, the momentum is, we never did it this way before. We never got rid of it. We never moved this machine over to this room. We never hooked things up this way. We never had our salespeople coming in and having meetings at 7 a.m., et cetera. You know, whatever the paradigm was, whatever the way we always did it before, the way we did it during the Depression, the way we did it in the 50s, the way we did it in the 60s, you know, how do you deal with that?
So I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to answer this the way you want me to. But here's my experience. Second and third generation business owners who are business people, not practitioners like Grandpa was, tend to be much more successful with the business. One, because they've already got something to start with. They've got a cash flow. Two, they come into the business as a business owner as opposed to a practitioner. See, remember that when Grandpa did it, he probably started off working for somebody, and the way that he evolved to a business person was by becoming the best practitioner at being a framer or doing countertops or whatever it is he did. He was really good at it. And so to him, the logical progression was that he would own his own business. But throughout the ownership of that business, he continued to derive his own personal self-esteem and self-worth based on the fact that he was extraordinarily good at it. That's why you hear small business owners say, if I could only clone myself, when in fact they really don't want to clone themselves, because if they do, then that takes away from who they are. They derive their self-esteem from being the best in their business. When the second generation comes in, they could care less about being the best this, that, or the other thing. All they want to know is efficiency and how do I make more money within the business, and I don't want to be the best mechanic or the best body man or the best framer or whatever it is.
Well, then how do they ensure that the quality that business was known for stays there?
Quality control is a part of business. But they're not. But look, here's the thing. In many cases, the person who is the very best, you've got to be in the high end of the market and have people willing to pay you that. So you'll find people who are perfectionists who build new construction homes below $300,000. Well, let me just tell you something. You're never going to be compensated for your extraordinary work because the market won't bear it. Now, if you want to be an extraordinary craftsman, build, you know, $5 and $10 million homes, and then you'll be compensated for it. So it depends on the way you come at it, right? But you have to certainly have quality. But my experience is this. The people who tend to be best at building and scaling businesses, that is to make them larger and larger by scale, are the people who tend not to be the best practitioner. You know, if they got a CPA firm with 50 people working for them, ironically, more often than not, the one who manages that business, who owns that business, may have a CPA designation, but they maybe were never really a great CPA at all, but they're a very good business person. And they build the big businesses.
Well, you see that in law firms all
absolutely.
The time.
Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, your
the guy
point,
runs the law firm's not the litigator.
Your point is exactly right. As a matter of fact, that's a detriment to the growth of a law firm right there.
Having a litigator.
Having
the managing
somebody
partner.
Who's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And remember something else. When you hire extraordinary people to come to work for you, they believe the logical progression is that they're going to work for you only long enough until they can figure out how to do it themselves, and then you just trained your own competition. you got to find
That's why we have no competes.
Yeah. And so that's problematic. And so everybody says, I want to hire the best people. Well, how are you going to retain those people when they all know they can go out on their own and make more money? How are you going to do that? See, and they're just gleaning experience through working for you. And as far as they're concerned, if they're young, that's just the logical progression.
Well, it is.
And when you get older, you say, screw that crap, right? I'm sick of training my own competition.
You don't want to. People ask me, well, we talked about this before. How do I do a podcast? Well, I'm not telling you. We don't need to have any more podcasts.
Right.
Okay, so quick summary, because we're kind of running out of time. So,
what a surprise!
If such a thing could happen in a podcast, but a quick summary of what your feelings are about this whole, you know, we never did this way before. The future is already written, you know, that kind of a thing. And I know, and this gets into your life experience too a little bit. Like, nothing is written, basically. If I know you've studied him, the guy that they made the movie, Sir Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, sure.
He encountered these guys, and when he would say, we're going to go across the desert and attack these guys, and he would say, they would say, we can't do that. It is written that we cannot do that. And he kept saying to them, nothing is written. We're writing it. And I've never forgotten that. And I just want to end with that on that point.
Well, it's great because he was adamant and embracing of that belief, and that's really good. You are fighting conventional wisdom, which of course is not wisdom at all.
It's just something everybody says.
Right. And so, you know, everybody has to take what they think they believe. And science is the whole idea of testing every theory, right? I mean, that's what it is. And so you don't start with a hypothesis, right? And so the whole point is that you have to be open enough to test it with empirical data. And in the world of money, business, and finance, those are numbers.
Yeah.
And a lot of people...
Which is actually money.
Yeah. And, people are frustratingly will say, I'm not a financial person. I'm not a numbers person. Every time I hear that, I want to bang people over the head with a rock and say, you will start to say, instead of programming your mind to say, I'm not a financial person, start saying, I will become a financial person. And then you can take what you know, your feelings, your emotions, your religion, all those things, and use that because you're not capable of not doing that. However, then equally vetted against the raw data that is the numbers. And then you arrive at a decision that is within your sensibilities but also makes sense. And if the numbers don't speak to the way you want to go, at least you know what you're doing.
Yes. So you're saying, you know, put aside your I don't even want to say put aside your emotions, because you're recognizing that people are emotional beings. But you're saying, you know, get the numbers and see where you're at with the numbers, and then at least you'll know where you are.
Because you're not going to get them to shut that component down, that emotional side. If you do, you're just wasting your time. They're going to have it. But what you can try to do is to get them to use... Somebody says, I'm going to lose money or I'm going to make money. The question for me is, and you know this about me, how much are you going to lose? Right? Because it may not seem
and
like...
how long are you going to lose it?
Right, exactly. How long is your burn rate going to go on? Because when you add zeros to that burn rate, where you might just say flippantly that I'm going to lose money, but if I show you the number of zeros behind those numbers, you might say, oh, whoa, wait a minute here. See, but people don't want to see that because they want to do what they want to do.
All right. Well, that's a great way to end the podcast. But I do have one more question. Do you hate your printer? I know you do. And it isn't the printer. It's the ridiculous. Why can't your company do something about these big box retailers that charge a fortune for these print cartridges? It's ridiculous. They are so expensive, but Todd and I both know someone that can help you out. That's Cartridge World of Maple Grove. They can save you 30% compared to the big box stores, and that is our friend Jason Waldron at Cartridge World in Maple Grove off of Weaver Lake Road between Dairy Queen and Subway. Do you get cartridges?
Absolutely.
You do?
It's really unbelievable. It's like buying a new printer every time you buy a cartridge. He does it for a third of the price.
He does. Phenomenal. It's amazing. 763-420-6632. That's 763-420-6632. Or click on the banner at the top of the page, bobdavispodcast.com. It says Cartridge World. And ask for Jason, and he will hook you up because he's hooking us up. He's hooking us up. All right. Thanks for listening to Todd Rooker and myself. Podcast 827 live in Mobile Podcast Command outside the world headquarters for Todd Rooker's amazing financial consulting company, which is what is the name of it again?
Financial Consulting.
I'm making you say it so I don't screw it up because I probably would. Thanks for listening to Podcast 827. The Bob Davis Podcast, available at iTunes for sure on Alexa. All you have to do is ask for Alexa to find the Bob Davis Podcasts. And of course, live at the BobDavisPodcasts.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 827. Good luck. Bye.
Was that okay?
Oh, that was great. I think, you know, it's such a... Here's the problem with it. I take these giant, I don't think of them as heavy, large topics, and then I try to winnow them down, and they're, this is a massive problem in our society right now. It's just, you could do 100 podcasts on this.
Brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Cross 110th Street is a hell of a tester.